Welcome to Failing Up, a brand new podcast where we explore failure, why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can rise directly from it. Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It can even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope that somehow this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening.
My name is Eden.
My name is Guy. Today we have a very special guest. I've experienced my own failures with him.
We're trying to talk to people about their failures and how their failures kind of shaped who they are.
Right. And when you think failure, you thought of me.
Obviously.
We're like, first person we want on our show is
who,
Andy.
Who
Laster.
Do we know?
It's not
a
that.
Big failure.
It's more of like, who's really... Well, I think no one successful has gotten there without failure.
I would agree with you.
So that's... We kind of actually...
I would agree with you.
Went for who do we know that we really respect and has success behind them.
And then you couldn't get... And you couldn't get those people. So then...
Hey, Michael Jackson's dead.
That's
so.
Right. So here I am.
Maybe in a sense, the more successful you are, the more you fail. Like, it takes more failure to get more successful. What do you think about that?
That could be... Yes. I mean, there are exceptions to everything. You do see people who just... And we hate those people who have just not had failure and just have succeeded. But I think we're in a business that you have a lot of failure in order to succeed. Because it's...
Absolutely.
You know, you have to swing a lot to get a hit.
True.
Take a lot of shots.
And you know, that's what they say. Even the best baseball players only got hits 30% of the time. Three out of every 10 times.
She doesn't understand what you're talking about. You lost her there.
Okay. We'll move on from the baseball references. But yeah, so I had failures with you, Andy, in the past.
I knew he was going to bring it up first.
I have, which is that I invited you to on my previous podcast, Decently
right.
Funny. But I mean, looking back on it, it probably just wasn't the right venue for you. Is that
Yeah,
would that be
I would say, yeah, I don't remember totally when. I just, you know, as somebody who's sort of out there and kind of people just associate me with Ellen, I just was always a little bit nervous too. Because I'm, you know, I just say what I think a lot of times and I'm always nervous of the repercussions. But I trust you. And I just wasn't, I don't know, this just, you just got me at a really good time. I literally just started hiatus and so I have nothing but free time this week. So I figured this is good.
That's amazing. Because it was a big failure. I mean, I'm sure Nuzzy asked you. I know I asked you a couple times and it couldn't happen. But it kind of shows right there, Eden. That's my failure that turned into a positive.
But can I just out this right now?
Sure.
Yes. I told Guy lots of times, I was like, bug him. He was really scared to ask you for
it. Oh my
it
God!
Wasn't scared.
It's I understand what you're saying.
He was like asking.
You should never be.
He was
nervous.
He was.
I
nervous.
Like you. You're literally one of the only people who I follow on Twitter who I've actually, both of you, who I've actually met.
Really?
You know, I mean, other than like Ellen and Andy Richter,
right?
But most people, like, you know,
they're just characters. Isn't that weird?
They're just. It's weird. Yeah. You're that cartoon Avi until I met you. I took you to a Kings game.
You came
sure
with
me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so jealous.
It was
fun. We went to a Kings
a lot of
game.
Fun.
Oh, I just peed my pants. I'm jealous.
I know.
He invited a couple other Twitter folks there, too, so don't let him kid you.
It was like a little... But who were they?
It
I don't
was,
remember.
But who were they?
It was you and Nuzzy in my head.
Yeah. And two other
It was
guys,
you and some other cartoon guy. I don't know.
No, I think it was someone from work. I don't know.
Okay,
was it?
Yeah, I think actually it might have been some writers from work.
Right.
And you do... Obviously, you work for The Ellen Show, but let's start at the beginning. Let's go way back.
Way back, go.
You were born in Colombia?
I was born in South America. My dad was... president of Seagram's Whiskey.
Oh, wow.
Down there. And so they moved. They got married, and within like 3 months, they moved down there. And my parents were, and my dad was not religious, but when he married my mother, they became religious. So my mother ran the Jewish school down there. And yeah, I was born there, and I was there till I was 4 years old.
So you can never be president.
I can never be president.
Wow.
But I still have dual citizenship. So
okay.
I can go there once shit hits the fan.
I
am welcome in Colombia.
Wow.
But I spoke fluent Spanish.
Yeah.
Didn't speak a word of English. Started Jewish school when I was 5. Well, not Jewish school, like the Jewish private school.
Right.
Right.
And the kid, I don't remember this obviously, but the kids made so much fun of me because I didn't understand English because I only spoke Spanish that somehow in my head I came home apparently and said I'm never speaking Spanish again. And everyone said it would come back when I take it in high school. No, never really.
Really?
Came back.
So you don't know Spanish?
I don't really know Spanish at all.
Huh. And your parents never spoke it to you at home?
No. And my mother's a language teacher.
Oh.
I know. She teaches Spanish and French.
Because, like, with me, my parents, I was born here. I was born at Cedars-Sinai. Like, I'm one of those rare people that's actually born in LA. And my parents refused to speak to me in English ever.
What did they speak to you in?
Hebrew.
Oh,
in
wow.
French.
Both Israeli?
My mom was Israeli. My dad was Belgian. My dad spoke to me in French a little bit, but he kind of gave up once my mom kept speaking to me in Hebrew.
And they weren't religious, really, were they?
No, my mom was Israeli, so they don't think that they owe God anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Very liberal.
My dad was a little bit, not religious, but they sent me to Jewish school because they were like, just learn, you know.
Well, that was, yeah, that was important to my parents, and it still is.
So we all went to Jewish schools. I went to Jewish school.
What Orthodox? I went to Orthodox.
Till I was sixth grade, I went to this school called Lakewood Hebrew Day School in Lakewood, New Jersey.
Lakewood, New Jersey. That's a big Jewish area.
Huge Jewish area. Like Orthodox Jewish
like
area.
Like major Orthodox.
But then, you know, in like fifth grade, I came in one day with a shirt that said, Maine, where lobster is king.
And that was done.
I was in trouble. Yeah. Don't do that, by the way. Yeah. And also don't wear this is my Halloween costume shirt. Don't wear that to your Jewish school because they don't like that.
The Jewish school I went to through 12th grade, my mother was not only the head of the language department, she was also the director of admissions.
Oh, wow.
Uh-oh.
And so I think that's where like trouble started for me because I was overcompensating because I didn't want to be the kid with the mom who works at the school. So I had to prove to everyone that I was, I don't know, some sort of clown. And so I sort of at that. And I also knew very early on that I wasn't fully on board for the Orthodox experience.
Okay, but when you're young, your parents are Orthodox?
100%.
Oh, wow.
100 modern Orthodox. Right. So in other words, not the curls, but I wore a yarmulke in the streets.
Use stuff on Shabbat?
You ate kosher?
No, oh, my God, Shabbos clocks. All our lights were on automatic
elevators.
Timers. Someone would we would walk because we lived on the seventh floor. Oh. And and if we ever needed to, whatever, then the doorman would press the button. So,
yeah.
And all the food was, you know, pre-cooked and...
Oh my
I mean, Orthodox. And to this day, my parents are. My dad's 93, and my mom still does it. And my brother, there's only me and my brother, and he's Orthodox. My grandfather, father, and brother were president of the Orthodox synagogue on the Upper East Side.
Wow.
Wow.
So you might have been expected to maybe follow.
Yeah, there was definitely expectation. And I'll be honest with you, and I love my parents. There's still disappointment. They still have a hard time with me being not religious.
So you said at what point, 12th grade, that's when you decide that, hey, or even earlier that Orthodox
I remember being in synagogue at a young age, 8, 9, 10, thinking, I don't know that this is for me. I remember, but it wasn't an option.
Yeah.
It was how things were. And it wasn't, I always admired people who were honest at that age, who could say to their parents, I'm not feeling it. Like, I was so nervous, to be honest with my, you know, I got married, my first marriage, I was like 25, 26, and they still believed I was religious. Like, I lied that far.
Wow.
Because I was so obsessed with not disappointing them. And, yeah.
So you're a kid, then you get out of high school, and you go to college, right?
I go to NYU, and I lose my fucking mind.
Before I ask about NYU, because I do have questions about that, I've noticed in your tweets before, around college admissions time, you're like, hey, kids, if you don't get into the first college, it's not the end of the world, and that's probably the right... wherever you go, that's the right thing for you.
That's two reasons. One is because I never finished NYU. I dropped out, and I...
joined the club.
And when I was in NYU, I was high the whole time. I was in a fraternity. I barely made it. God bless my parents. They kept paying tuition, and I barely, you know. But that was also my first exposure to...
the outside world.
The
really.
Outside world. Even though I lived in Manhattan and I had seen it, it wasn't until I was outside from under my parents' roof that, like, you know. And I don't believe that's why I turned to drugs. I believe I was predisposed to abuse substances. But it does make it a lot easier when you have all this pent up, like... So I show up at NYU and there's girls and there's drugs and there's your own room and there's no rules. And so I definitely, you know, I have a cousin who grew up the exact same way as me, but by 15, he was honest with his parents. 16, he was telling him that, and I just didn't have, for whatever reason.
You couldn't do it. No. So was NYU your first choice then?
NYU was, I believe so. It was, I wasn't huge... I can't remember. I applied to very few schools, and at that time, NYU wasn't what it is now. It's so hard to get into
all
now.
All schools aren't what they used to
be. I know. I can't. Like, I hear, like, the party schools that were party schools when I was going are now, like, so hard to get in.
I know.
And just, And also, my daughter, you know, she just went through that. She just finished her freshman year of college, and she went through, you know, disappointment not getting into certain schools, and then, but she ended up where she belongs. But being exposed to that and... friends' kids, I realized there's way too much pressure put on it.
So much pressure.
Yeah.
And I always say, you know, when I interview people, which I'm, you know, for jobs, I look at the resume, I look at the school, but especially in my business, I hire the most interesting person in the room. And the most interesting person in the room may have dropped out after 2 years, may have gone to a liberal arts school and not studied anything to do with television, right, but they're interesting. So,
yeah. I'm a firm believer that if you really want to learn something, you don't need a school to teach it to you.
Like, I agree. Unless you're going to do one of those professions like medicine and law, yes, which I was never going
to
do.
Obviously, if you're going to operate on me, I'd like to see some credentials.
Sure. It'd be great if you had some education.
Yeah.
Or a Jewish last name. That works too.
I mean,
that's true.
Or an Asian last name.
I was going to say, my brother and I both went to college and finished college, but the first person to make six figures out of the three of us was the little sister who dropped out her junior year of college. So
there you go. What does she do?
She sells right now education something or other.
Yeah.
But she's like the top salesperson in her company. Yeah,
I dropped
and has
out
been
of college
for a long time.
But I grew up in a family and they considered themselves secular Orthodox people, that it was important for me to have some sort of career.
Right.
But never in a million years did I think I'd be doing what I'm doing. And that was pressure on me because I had no idea what I wanted to do, too.
You're growing up. What do you imagine you're going to be doing?
I thought I was going to end up on Wall Street just because all the rich guys in my synagogue,
that's what they did.
And I wanted to be rich. And right. So that's what I thought I had to do. But so I did that for a couple summers for a very successful guy, but I just couldn't catch on. Like, I wasn't good with the numbers, and you kind of have to be. And so, yeah, it didn't work out for me. But that's what I absolutely thought. Because not because I had any interest in it, but just the coolest people in my synagogue worked on Wall Street and were around money, and I liked money.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
So let's go to NYU.
You
lose your mind when you get there.
I lose my mind.
Do you remember like the biggest like culture shock or like the greatest part about it for you? I mean, was it just the drugs or was it?
It was drugs. It was girls can sleep over in your room. Mm-hmm. You can sleep over in their room. It was not, I mean, it sounds crazy, but it was not having to be strictly Orthodox on Saturdays. It was being able to get into a cab on a Saturday. It was being able to go to a party on a Friday night. Yeah. And I was attracted to the feeling of doing something that I perceived to be wrong from an early age. Yeah. And that
the
I felt guilty about.
Yeah.
It was freedom, but it was also like, ooh, this is wrong. It was taboo. And it was like, you know, the first time you eat on kosher for me was, I was 18. I had never eaten anything. So the first time you have bacon, or you go, holy shit. Yeah. Like, and there's a rush to that.
How could lobster not be kosher?
Exactly.
Right. I mean, I remember, like, see, my parents are Israeli too. We didn't keep kosher in the house. And so I remember going to a friend's house who kept kosher, and he's like, do you want hot dogs or we can have some milk? And I'm like, why can't we have both? He's like, no.
We
Milchiks and Fleishiks.
Milchiks and Fleishiks.
Can't
we
do
had
that.
The two separate sinks, of course.
Yeah.
I went to a Jewish high school and my mom sent me with ham sandwiches. Temple Emanuel.
Oh.
Yeah. Nice. Way back when they had a women rabbi. I don't think they do anymore.
And you know, if you aren't familiar with that whole thing, I feel like being an Orthodox Jew, there's some kind of similarity with being Amish. What do you think about that?
I would say, yeah.
I mean, just
it. Yes. I think any extreme form where you sort of ghettoize yourselves in the religion, I think there's a lot of similarity. And I have to say, I just want to say, I have a lot of respect for my parents and my brother that they still do it. I think I went through a stage where I was pissed off about religion and that I had to grow up that way. And now as I get older, I have complete respect for it. And it's just not for me. It's just not, you know.
Day one, you come to NYU. Are you Orthodox still?
No.
Oh, you're immediately dropped.
Well, here's the thing. I graduate high school. I spend a year, as every kid did around my time, in Israel.
Birthright.
I go there to yeshiva.
Yes.
So now I'm going to an Orthodox black hat yeshiva to be hopefully become very religious. And the hope for a lot of them is that you end up staying in Israel and put off college to study Torah.
Right.
But instead, I get thrown out of there after 6 months with two other guys, and they move us up to the north because I begged them. I said, you can't tell my mother. She's like the director of admissions of a prominent, like, you cannot tell her. You will crush her. I begged the rabbi, and he said, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to send you up north, and you're going to teach Israeli kids English.
Okay.
And I went up there, and that's where it all, drinking and...
Okay, you know. Let's rewind for one more second. What'd you do that was so bad that got you kicked out?
Nothing. That's the thing. It was such a strict school. What I did was I didn't go to class, and they wanted you to learn Torah all day, and I would just sleep in. I would go into town at night and drink and not be able to get up the next day.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm exposed to alcohol. In my opinion, I'm drinking alcoholically. As I look back now, I didn't know then.
Right.
Right from the get-go. So I'm drunk a lot
and
not getting up. And to them, that's, you know, why are you here? And I also questioned a lot in classes. I sort of, these hardcore rabbis, I would sort of challenge them, but not in a respectful way. In a, how are you fucking devoting your life to this kind of way, which didn't sit well with them. And so
it sounds like every angry college student, you know, just like angsty against.
And, you know, and the idea, you know, and now in retrospect, I wouldn't do that. And I do, I'm a big fan of people. I don't believe that you're that everybody when they graduate high school is necessarily ready 2 months later to go to college. Yeah. I think my daughter didn't want to do it, but if my sons want to, like, I'm all for taking a year or two and growing up and taking a job, you know, teaching scuba diving somewhere or working at the Jamba Juice for a year and sort of start figuring out, what do I really want to do? Because suddenly you're a freshman 2 months after being in high school and you got to figure out your life.
But wasn't that also you doing that? What you were saying is kind of was a downfall for you in a sense, because that's what started you really.
Yes, that's what
exposed.
Because it was like even more religion, and I was like, this is crazy, and that's why when I went to NYU, it was. And yes, right from the get go, I knew I wasn't going to be religious. I was already. That summer was when I first ate on kosher. We left Israel. I somehow convinced my parents to give me enough money to travel Europe for 3 weeks. And I think in Italy was the first time.
It's a good place to break it.
I think I ate on kosher for the first time. And so I always knew in me, but I genuinely believed at the time as an 18-year-old that I was just going to keep lying to my parents for the rest of my life. I was just like, it never dawned on me that I could just be honest.
And you did. Wow. And you did it until you said you were 25 years old. So that's a long time to hold on to it.
I'm trying to think. When I won my first Emmy for Rosie O'Donnell, the Emmys were on a Friday night, and I told my parents that I was walking down because it was at Radio City. Yeah. And I said, I'm going to walk to the Emmys and walk home because I couldn't break their heart and tell them I was going to the Emmys and being in a cab on Shabbos.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
And obviously, that's exactly what
and
you
And it
did.
Wasn't their fault. It was just something in me. It wasn't about them. It was about me. To this day, I still struggle with it, not wanting to disappoint someone.
Yeah.
I'm such that people pleaser, and then when you have three kids, you try and you start seeing that in them, you just want to break that habit. Yeah. But for me, it was all about wanting my parents to think I was everything, wanting Rosie O'Donnell to think I was. It's this need for everyone to like you, and it's what gets you into trouble a lot of the time, because then you're not really an authentic person. You're whatever guy wants me to be, and then when I'm with Eden, I'll be what Eden needs me to be, and because I just want to be liked.
Should we just break it to him?
Yeah. We never liked you.
I know. That's why I'm saying. That's why I said yes to this. Because I said, here's two people who generally don't like me.
Oh, I was going to say, Guy, we should correct him.
What's that?
How'd you say my name?
Oh.
Eden? It's not Eden?
No.
How do you say it in Hebrew?
Edan?
Eden.
Eden. In Hebrew, isn't it Edan? Eden.
Gan Eden.
Oh, Gan Eden.
Yeah. It's Eden.
Yes. We can edit that if you really want.
I just know people are going to be angry that know me. They're going to be like, why did he say your name wrong?
Oh my God.
Yeah,
people who know you.
When I've been on TV and they introduce me and they don't say my name right, all my friends watching are like, it was cute, but they didn't say your name right.
Hilarious.
I was like, okay.
Yeah, Eden. I've had that issue myself.
But anyway, I find it interesting though that you see it in your kids too.
Yeah. Oh, that's the hardest thing about being a parent is where you start seeing the stuff that you do that you're not happy about doing, and you see it in them, and then you're like, you know, I already see one son. I am certainly not diagnosing it. I have severe ADD. I'm not diagnosing it in him, but he has issues. I sometimes see he's not focused, and I'm trying to talk to him, and I get so impatient with him, and then I'm realizing it's because I can't stand that part of myself sometimes.
Right.
That my complete inability to focus.
I'm going to back up again even more. So we're back at NYU. I'm still there personally in my head. I'm Andy Lassner at NYU.
Yes,
I'm going crazy. What kind of drugs do we do? We
start with pot,
okay,
and then become a daily pot smoker very quickly. And there was, I'm trying to think what it was called, Dial-A-Weed or something. There was a service where you could call.
Well, whoa. It was New York. Yeah,
yeah.
New York,
yeah. And you called, and guys would show up on bikes, these hippie looking.
Yeah.
And it would be a menu. You'd say, "What's on the menu tonight?" And they'd show up with bicycles. These guys, they were like hippie looking dudes, and they would just deliver pot to you. And I wasn't working, so I mean, I worked in the summer, but a lot of it was just, you know, my spending money, or I cashed in my meal plan from the kosher kitchen and used that.
They let you do that?
Yeah, they let me do that. I said, I decided I'm just going to eat on my own.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
so
give you your
First it was pot. And then I think it was, I had a friend, a very good friend who I grew up with, who became a bouncer at Studio 54.
Oh, wow.
Not a bouncer. He worked the door. He's not a big guy. He worked the door and sort of told the bouncers who to let in, kind of thing.
Right.
But they would confiscate drugs when you tried to get in with drugs. Mm-hmm. And so he'd have a whole bowl of drugs by the end of the night. And that's the first time I tried cocaine, was at Studio 54.
Wow. That's and a I went good place into a to bathroom. Try it, if you're going to try it.
Yes. And I think that was, I think I was maybe my sophomore year wow. of college. And I remember to this day, I went into a bathroom stall. He explained me how to do it. And I remember I did it the first time. And I didn't really feel anything. He said, try a little more. And I remember about 10 minutes later going, oh, this is what normal people feel like. That's what it did for me. It gave me confidence. I didn't feel short anymore. I didn't feel like that short, insecure Jew. I was able to talk to people. And I was like, oh, this is what I need to just be like other people who can function. And I loved it. And it was instant. And then that was also time, just, you know, that's how old I am. I'm 48. Mm. So it was also the time crack cocaine was introduced to Washington Square Park. That's right. where it sort of started.
Right.
And then I tried that and then, you know, lost wow. my mind.
And it was just one of those, is it the classic, hey, if coke gets me this high, what's crack going to do for me? Or
yes.
Okay.
And it was cheaper.
Yeah.
Crack was cheaper than cocaine. And then I started dating a girl who had a boyfriend. She was a commuter from Brooklyn and her boyfriend was a dealer. And she would get coke from him while I was dating her. And she didn't know that we were, obviously he didn't know.
Right.
And everyone was like, you know how dangerous this is? You're like stealing, you're getting coke from the girlfriend of an Italian drug dealer.
Oh my God. Yeah. The picture of that.
I know.
Is just
and I just didn't think at the, I just thought I'm getting coke for really cheap or free. So it worked out.
Here's like, yeah, this is actually bringing a question. Did anybody see this in you, this change, and like sit you down and
people
say,
you know,
like,
it's funny, there was one kid, Mark, who was went to my high school, and he was in the same fraternity, because at the time you couldn't live at NYU if your parents lived in the city because they didn't have enough housing. So the only way that he and I could was by pledging a fraternity, because
okay.
they had their own housing. So he was pre-med, and he's the one who's now, he's a plastic surgeon now in New York, but he would keep saying, dude, you're out of control.
Yeah. You're doing crack. Do your parents know?
Like that, no, at this time, crack, at this but. Time, they don't know. I'm avoiding going home on weekends. So I'm literally showing up for maybe one Sabbath a month. And then I would just try and get it together.
And they don't know enough to be concerned.
They don't know. And they never, you know,
they didn't
God
ask.
Bless my mother. They never asked for report cards.
Wow.
I mean, I had dropped like
oh
two
God.
Or four classes every semester.
My dad would
just
call me every day to see what
I know.
I'm
and like my
school.
Daughter, I'm like, how are you doing at school? What's going on? Like it
are
was,
you on the
what
list?
Are your grades? What are you, you
yeah.
know? And I just told my parents I did well and they never asked. And it was amazing.
Wow.
And obviously once I finally got sober for real, I had a lot of amends to make to them because I was basically just stealing their money
right.
and not doing anything at NYU.
But while you're still all screwed up, mm-hmm. you go from crack to heroin?
No heroin at this
okay.
point. Heroin doesn't come into the picture until the second time, until after Rosie O'Donnell.
Wow.
So that's not true. I tried heroin, but mm-hmm. soon after got clean. But I did every drug. You know, there was all sorts of things like mescaline and ecstasy had just started. And
yeah.
and I drank a lot. You know, there are a lot of people who say, you know, I can drink, but I can't do drugs. I'm like, I can't do anything. So the people who love coke aren't big drinkers. That wasn't
right.
the case with me. I whatever I could do to sort of get rid of that uncomfortable feeling about myself worked.
And so at what point do you actually realize, okay, screw college, I'm out of here, right?
It wasn't like that. What happened was I was really high one night and a guy came on the television in the common area, which was Morton Downey Jr.
Yeah.
If you remember,
yes.
She's too young.
I know.
No, you don't know.
He was a
you don't
sleazeball.
Even know. Yeah,
he's dead now.
And
yeah.
he
oh,
and
now.
He taped a show in Secaucus, New Jersey. And I said, "That's what I want to do for a living." Because at this point, I started by being an accounting major, and I couldn't do numbers. I wasn't really doing anything, and so I had to declare a major. So I just said journalism, and then I did this, and I called them up, and I said, "I want to work for you." And they said, "Well, you can do an internship if you're in college." And I went and I got an internship, and within like 3 months, they offered me a job. And so I told my parents I was going to go to school part-time, which...
Again with the line.
Wow.
Yeah.
Morton Downey Jr.
Yeah.
was your
Morton
beginning.
Morton Downey Jr.
That's
was
amazing.
My first. And then I quickly became the guy. He got these like $8,000 or $10,000 a weekend speaking gigs where he'd just go to colleges and talk. And I would go and produce those for him, and he'd give me $1,000.
Wow.
Which...
Why do you do
Which
why do you make quotation?
In 1987, A
ton of money.
Yeah. Because 1987, $1,000 every other weekend to a drug addict was like, it was unbelievable for me.
Yeah.
And also, like it or not, Morton Downey Jr. was sort of well known at the time. So all of a sudden, I sort of fell into this kind of cool thing I was doing for a living.
So you're doing this and you're a functioning drug addict?
I'm doing it and I'm a functioning drug addict. Yes. And I'm in my senior year of college and I'm not really going to classes. And one of my really, wow, I'm really being honest here. One of my really good friends in college, his girlfriend, he went back home to California for the summer. And I slept with his girlfriend.
Okay.
And she decided to get honest and tell him once we were back at school. And didn't tell me that she told him. And
oh, then, that's a horrible.
Yeah, and then he confronted me, and I swear to God, the way I dealt with it, and the whole fraternity, everyone knew before he confronted me. And the way I dealt with it was I called my mom. I was horrified. I called my mom. I said, you know what? For these last two semesters, I think I want to live at home. And that day, I packed up my bag and left and just never stayed in contact with anyone because I was so humiliated, and it was such a horrible thing that I had done. He was one of my really close friends. And
but that kind
so
of ties into being disappointing people, you know?
Yes.
You just didn't want to be around.
I couldn't face anyone, but that's what I did. I just escaped. And then, so I lived at home, and then what happened was I became a raging alcoholic where I was drinking morning to night.
Even though you're living with your Orthodox parents?
In my old childhood room. And I'm leaving during the day to go work at Morton Downey Jr.,
yeah.
But I'm also coming home and just drink. I'm drunk all the time.
Manischewitz?
Mort, God bless him. Yeah. No, it was actually Southern Comfort because it had sugar, and I was drinking so much that I wasn't eating. And he, God bless him, liked to drink too. So it was sort of an atmosphere where people didn't really know. Then my parents confronted me about alcohol missing, and I kept saying it was the housekeeper because I don't drink. And I can't remember the exact thing, but one night, this Hallmark Hall of Fame movie called My Name is Bill W., which was the story of AA,
yeah.
Starring James Woods, came on. And basically, there was a scene where I was like, oh, that's me. Like, that's my, like, and I walked into my parents' room and I said, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And that was the beginning of 8 years of sobriety.
Okay.
I'm actually really impressed that a Hallmark movie.
I know.
Had an impact.
I know.
They aren't all shooting.
And I so disagree with James Woods now politically. So
oh, of course.
I know.
It's weird, right?
So it's so heartbreaking, but he was so amazing in that role.
Co-starring Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly. The next one.
You don't think that these roles do something, but they could
Changed my life. He had this scene where he was standing outside a window. He was looking outside the window at like 7 in the morning and describing to his wife how he sees these people going to work and he wishes he could do that, but he can't stop drinking and he doesn't feel like a regular person and that he can live in the, whatever. I can't remember the exact scene, but I remember thinking, this is me. And the movie was about the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that started me. And then I told my parents and then I had to.
Did you join AA?
Tell people, yeah, immediately.
So during those years of sobriety, where are you working?
So then I get a job at Morton Downey Jr. as an associate producer.
Great.
That show ends after he draws a swastika on his face
right.
in the mirror.
Right.
Backwards. He draws it backwards because yeah. it was in the mirror because he wanted to say he was attacked by skinheads to get attention, and they figured that out, and very quickly the show imploded.
Otherwise, though, sorry not to cut you off, but otherwise, did you like the guy?
I did like him.
Okay.
I did like him because. You know, and he was a big right-wing Republican. Like,
yeah.
Everything was pro-guns. But I liked him, and I also liked the line of work. I liked the idea of working on something all day, and then that night it happens. It was a nightly show.
Right.
And then it's over. Because with my attention span, idea of a daily talk show was perfect for me. Because you work on something, and then it's over. Good or bad, you're done, and you got to start something new the next day, and it's not this long. I was never good at term papers or things that took a lot. I was good at the quick.
It's good for ADD.
Yes, it works for ADD.
So Morton Downey explodes.
He implodes, and it's shooting in New Jersey, and they're starting a daily three-hour talk show with a guy named Matt Lauer as the host. And they hired me as either a I can't even remember. I think I had to go down from associate producer to a PA, but I just wanted to keep working. And I worked there, and I became, that's how I became friends with Matt. And he was eventually fired from that, and they brought in a guy named Richard Bay.
Yes.
If you remember.
Of course.
And
this is WWOR we're talking
WWOR,
about.
WWOR, Secaucus, New Jersey. And
Richard Bay was another schlock kind
yes,
of guy.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I, you know, and that was, you know, I was doing TV that I was a little embarrassed of, but at the same time, I was like 21 or 22, and I think I had gotten my first producer credit on that show. And then I got a call from someone got my name. Oh, my friend Ed, who I work with now, who's the other executive producer at Ellen. Ed was an associate producer on Morton Downey, and he got hired by Donahue.
Wow.
Which was a huge thing.
Yes.
And then at Richard Bay, I was doing some shows that were getting attention, even though it was local. He could then do some of those guests because it was national, so he didn't care. And I remember we did this thing with these club kids, which was a huge thing.
Yeah.
I did a show with like 8 club kids, and it was outrageous, and Morton screamed at them, and because their whole life was sleeping all day and then going to the clubs
right.
at night and dressing up and doing
yeah.
drugs. And I gave him a couple shows at Donahue, and somehow he got my name and around a little bit. And somehow I got a call from Warner Brothers, and they called me to do a show called the Jane Whitney Show.
Okay.
And then I was like, I moved up very quickly to like a coordinating producer. And then that got canceled, and then Warner Brothers kept me on. Carney Wilson had a talk show
from
Wilson Phillips.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then my big break came when that ended, because there was this whole blowback about these talk shows after the Jenny Jones murder.
Right.
That
oh,
these won
yeah.
out. So I was like, oh, this is all I've done is conflict talk. But I had a contract at Warner Brothers where they had to pay me for another year. So they moved me down from like super to just a regular producer on Rosie O'Donnell.
Okay.
And then within like, and they were like, you know, you've only dealt with real people. You haven't dealt with celebrities, whatever. But it ended up working out.
So since failure is the topic, when you lost these jobs, it doesn't sound like you felt a sense of failure because you were still employed.
Right.
You were under contract.
My real first sense of failure was when after a year at Rosie O'Donnell, I start thinking, I've been sober like 7-8 years, and I think maybe I overreacted, and everybody gets high in college. So I start drinking. And again, I've gotten married at this point too.
Yeah.
To a nice Jewish girl who would make my parents happy, who grew up the same way I did, but wasn't as religious. And so she knew that I was an alcoholic, so I couldn't drink. So Scope insulted Rosie O'Donnell. It was mm-hmm. a big thing. They said she was the least kissable celebrity. Some poll they did.
Right.
It was horrible. And so then Listerine said, you're our friend. And they sent crates and crates of Listerine. And I relapsed drinking Listerine.
You're kidding.
No.
That's
how it started.
That's where you actually started.
I started
so
drinking.
Wait, are you
because people are saying, because I'm looking at this bottle, there's crates in our offices, and it says it's like 70% alcohol by
right.
something crazy. And it's yellow and it's gross. And
yeah,
and jealous. I'm having a hard time with Rosie because I, you know, I love her dearly, but she was, you know, she was tough and mm-hmm. and I was anxious, and I had stopped going to AA because
you stopped at this point.
I had stopped going to AA like 2 or 3 years before.
Oh, okay.
Because I remember thinking, I've got this thing.
Yeah.
I got it. I don't want to drink. I don't like, and I couldn't keep going and hearing people talk about 20 years ago, I got sober. And I'm like,
right.
well, then get on with your life. Like, why are we still in this church basement
right.
talk? Which was obviously not the right thing. But so now it's been like 2 or 3 years that I wasn't waking up in the morning saying, oh yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Because mm-hmm. I wasn't talking to alcoholics. I wasn't. That's why it's important that you do that.
Right.
Because when you're not around it, you start thinking, oh, I'm not different. I can maybe have a drink. I did overreact, whatever. And so, yeah, so that's how it started. It started with that and taking Tylenol PMs, and I thought I was fooling everyone, and I was drinking, at one point, I was drinking about 32 ounces of Listerine a day.
Oh.
And we went to see a play. I had a kid, my daughter Erin, and she was like 3 years old, and we took her to some puppet show, and Jessica, my ex-wife, leaned into me and says, you stink. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, I know that you're drinking the Listerine. And I go, what are you talking about? She goes, it's in your pores. It's coming out of you. I smell it all night in bed. It's disgusting, and you need to get help. And I said, you're crazy. I don't know what you're talking. I just full on denied it.
Well, of course,
and
that's
then,
the first stage, right?
Denial.
Yeah. And then, so I full on denied that. And then I said, oh, I got to figure this out. Long story short, I got access to Vicodin and pills. And then had a nephew who got into heroin, and then he, in everyone thinking that I'm going to help him, I got introduced to heroin.
Right.
And that was a love affair. And it got to the point at the end, you know, I was doing heroin in the nursery that was attached to Rosie O'Donnell, because she had her first kid. And I started doing heroin. I would go into the nursery there and lock the door after she had left for the day, because she had a nursery attached to her.
Snorting it? Shooting it
started
up.
Snorting it, okay. And then shooting it.
Wow, so you were full-on shooting up.
Which was crazy, because...
And you're the
I was
producer.
Also, I'm also the supervising producer of the Rosie O'Donnell show.
It's crazy.
And I'm trying to keep a marriage together, which isn't going great. And I have a three-year-old daughter. And that's why I really believe in addiction being a disease. Because if you ask me, I couldn't love anyone or anything more than I loved my daughter. But that didn't stop me from leaving her in a taxi to run up and score drugs and then just trust this taxi driver that I had just met to just keep an eye on my daughter in Washington Heights.
Wow.
And that's why it just takes over.
At that point, does anybody know?
At this point, my wife knows, and she starts because she found a bunch of pills and gave it to my brother, and he got them analyzed at a lab.
Oh my
God. And then they confronted me. And I said, I'm fine, and it's all good. I was taking Vicodin for pain, and we need to move. The problem was New York, in my mind, is what I told them, is because in my head I was still trying to please my parents, and that caused a bunch of stress because they were three blocks away, and I had to still go to synagogue and all this stuff. And I said, I'm going to start new and go to L.A., and I started interviewing for jobs. At the same time that Rosie, I believe, and Warner Brothers was going to let me go because... I became belligerent, I talked back to her, and I didn't care anymore. I just stopped caring, and I was abusing, I was like 12 or 15 Vicodin a day.
Wow.
And then heroin, and then I come out here, and we move, and within like 2 weeks, my wife confronts me again and says, you're out of control. I've taken a job out here as a senior vice president of King World.
Wow.
And I asked them after like 3 months, my wife was in New York with our daughter, and said, I'm not coming back with your daughter unless you go to rehab. And so I went to rehab here, a place called Exodus in Marina Del Rey, and made it 28 days. And then about 3 months into sobriety and going to meetings again and working for King World, who was nice enough 2 months into my job to give me a month to go to rehab.
Right.
A girl from rehab calls me and says, I just bought a bunch of coke. I'm having a hard time. I don't know what to do. And my best thinking wasn't call another female. Let's call someone from rehab. I had met her in rehab.
Yeah.
My best thinking was, I'm on my way over. I'm going to help you. And that turned into like a 1 week run with her. And we ended up with her ex-boyfriend in the Valley and doing heroin again. And right back to rehab. And this guy Dallas Taylor, who unfortunately just passed away, he was the drummer for Crosby, Stills and Nash, was doing interventions, and he said you need to leave LA, and he came and got me, and they put me on a plane and took me to Arizona. And so it's a second rehab, and they allow for it at King World. They're saying
that's
okay.
Insane.
Yeah, I know. Wow. It's crazy. And then about 2 weeks into it, they called me and said, you're done, you don't have a job.
Wow.
And then so in Arizona, then it was also told to me by the rehab people that if you go back to LA and just go back to work, you're going to die. So if you can't afford it, which I really couldn't, you need to take time off and commit yourself to recovery full time. And so I came back and I moved into a sober living, and that's what I did.
How long were you at sober living?
A year. They made me commit to a year. So now I've separated from my wife. She's here with my daughter, too, and I'm seeing my daughter on weekends, but I can't say, here's where Daddy lives with 12 men sharing one toilet. So I would meet her. She'd go, Daddy, where are you living? And I said, over there. It's just too far. And I would take her to Venice, and I would take her to Marina Del Rey, and we would just... I was like Disneyland. I was like the greatest dad, because I would have her for weekends. We'd stay in a hotel for a night. And they made me commit. I mean, I could have done whatever I wanted, but they made me commit to a year of sober living, which...
I did sober living for 6 months.
Did you really?
Yeah, and then I did inpatient for another 6 months. So I consider that both.
Yeah.
Here's the problem with that for me personally. Sorry if I'm...
No, go ahead.
Going into my problems. But I, when I was done with sober living, I moved into an apartment with another girl from sober living. Right. We're like, oh, this could work out. We'll go to inpatient together. We'll come back home. We'll keep each other safe. Yeah. And I think that was really hard for me.
That's a hard situation. Yeah.
Yeah.
After my year of sober living, I moved in with a guy and it worked out. But but the first time when I was in rehab in Exodus over here, within the first week, I like freaked out and was like, I can't do this. And they had this outside patio with a wall and I jumped the wall. I didn't know Marina Del Rey. I didn't know the area. And I started walking. Long story short, they got me. They followed me. They brought me back. They said, just so you know, you're an adult. You don't have to stay here. You don't have to go over the wall. Meanwhile, I'm bleeding from my knees because I fell like 8 feet onto, like, I'm bloodied. And they're like, if you want to sign out, you can sign out. Yeah. And I said, okay, I get it. I just wanted to get high so badly.
Yeah.
But eventually it all worked.
Do you have something in your mind when I say the words rock bottom? Did you have something that you consider a rock bottom?
Yeah, I think I had a lot of bottoms. Like I had, you know, I hung out at the bottom for a while. I made myself comfortable at the bottom. So I would say rock bottom was sort of that whole year of moving here, of not being faithful to my wife, of, you know,
escaping rehab,
of missing my daughter's birthday. That week that I told you where I went on a run with that girl, yeah. I missed my daughter's birthday party. That was my bottom. I think my bottom was thinking I'm losing my daughter. And just looking in the mirror going, I'm literally on the edge of a cliff and I'm done. Like I can't, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
And and you can't get sober for somebody because it doesn't work. If you say, you know, okay, honey, I'm doing it for you, or I'm going to do it for my kids. Right. You have to within yourself know you got to do it. Cause I knew already that my daughter who I loved couldn't keep me sober, but there was something that just a switch just flipped that said, I want to at least try legitimately to live and get clean. And it's not a fun life at the end, because when you're doing heroin, you don't get high anymore. You're just getting well.
Right.
Once you get addicted to heroin, it's not like, oh God, I'm going to get so high. I'm just getting not sick.
Right.
Because you get so sick when you're off of it, taking yourself off of it.
And you didn't get any of those nice Subutex drugs or anything like that. You actually probably had to go through the full withdrawal.
Well, I had to go through withdrawal, but what they do in rehab is they sort of ease the fall. They medicate you for a few days and then they take you down, you know, but I wasn't going to go the methadone route. I knew I had to get clean because and God bless people who do methadone. For me, methadone was not an option because I knew I had to get it all out of my system.
So you're fired from King World now.
I'm fired from King World. I have no job. I have nothing. And I'm living in a sober living and we really have no savings, like literally no savings. And so my wife is here in this area, right around here, with my daughter and living on like nothing. I don't remember how we were affording to pay for anything. And I get a call, someone gives my name to VH1 and they hire me for, I can't remember, but it was barely above what we paid like PAs on a syndicated show.
Wow.
But not much more to produce a show, this like rotating show. It was called The List for VH1. And that was the job I took because I needed something. And so all the money from that went to pay my wife's rent and the $300 or $400 it cost me to live in sober living. And from there, my agent stuck by me the whole time, which was amazing, called me and said, are you ready to do interviews? Are you ready to meet people? And so I said yes. And then I got a job at Fox, an overall deal to create shows. And that nothing really happened there other than my old bosses at Warner Brothers calling me saying, and these were the ones who had basically were done with me. And they said, we just signed Ellen DeGeneres. What do you think of her? And I said, I love her. And they said, and now I'm probably about 4 years sober. And I said, I love that woman. I think she had just hosted the Emmys and it was right after 9/11. And she sort of, everyone felt like they could laugh again after she hosted. It was like very memorable. And I loved her. And so I came in there and started as a supervising producer, and then after 1 year they made me a co-executive producer, and at the end of that season they made me an executive producer.
So this is the part of the show that I think is probably going to be my favorite, which is
showing
that the phoenix rising from the ashes, right?
Yes.
Because now, how long have you been sober now?
I've now been sober 16 years. March 1st was 16 years.
You've been on Ellen for how long?
We're going into season 13.
You have 10 Emmys? How many Emmys
I have
do you
18
have?
Emmys.
18 from Ellen?
No, I have a couple from Rosie, okay. And then a bunch from Ellen, because I, as an executive producer, you don't only get for best show. I've gotten them for the website. There's an Emmy cat. Now, when I say 18 Emmys, we're talking daytime Emmys.
That's still important.
I know, it's still important. But I know, I always, people get mad at me, but I always say, like 20 daytime Emmys probably equal one primetime Emmy.
No.
But yes, but you know.
No, it's, I don't think we should qualify.
I have a cotillion championship that I
but
won.
But it's so funny, like when at Rosie O'Donnell, when I won my first Emmy, the daytime Emmys were like a primetime event on ABC.
Yeah.
Last year, the daytime Emmys were a webcast. And then this year, they got back on TV on Pop TV or something.
Okay.
Some new channel.
Not real?
It's just funny because they realized as soap operas went away, and it was so funny to win talk show Emmys, no one really cares about it. They're all soap opera fans.
Yeah.
It's such a...
Oh, really?
And that's what made it. They were at Radio City Music Hall. They were a huge event, red carpet, everything. And now we're a webcast.
You won 18 times where Susan Lucci couldn't win.
Exactly.
Correct?
She finally won, I think. Did
she win?
Yeah, in Vegas, when they were in Vegas.
Huh.
Yeah.
In a work sense, is that actually fulfilling for you? Or is it just like,
another one to add.
It's fulfilling, but, you know, I have that personality that... If I enjoy anything too much, it's going to get taken away. It's my fear. So
like
I never...
Every Jewish fear, I think,
it's every
though.
Jewish fear, and it's every... But the key to me staying sober has been staying in touch with other alcoholics and reminding myself every day that I'm an alcoholic. Because I want to forget it. Believe me, I don't... Yeah. The last thing I want to do is sit in a room with other drunks and talk about how we are alcoholics and drug addicts. But it seems to be the only thing that works. For me. I know there's people, and I've met people. It's very frustrating because you meet a lot of people who are like, yeah, I had a huge coke problem, but I can drink recreationally now. Or I can't do alcohol, but I can smoke pot. Like for me, anything takes me right back. I'm a garbage can, which I'm actually grateful for, so I don't have to make any deals in my head of like, maybe I'll try this.
Or right.
Maybe. And yeah.
So now your parents, are they both still with us?
They are both still with us.
Both Orthodox?
Both
still?
Orthodox. My dad's 93.
Wow.
My mom is, whatever, 77.
How
whatever
much
16 years younger is.
Yeah. How much of your story do they know?
They know pretty much all of it. Because I had to make amends to them. You know, I had to work the steps. So
yeah.
I made amends to them. I think there's parts that maybe they don't fully know, but once they listen to this, they will.
But they aren't disappointed.
But they are, you know, but we've gone through a lot. I remember when I was in rehab and they came to visit. The biggest, I said, I need cigarettes. And I can't remember. It was like, they said, what do you need? And I said, I need like shampoo, whatever. And I need cigarettes. And my mother goes, oh my God, are you smoking? Like, that's so bad for you. And I go, Mom, I'm detoxing from heroin. Right. Cigarettes are the least of my problems.
Just give me this.
I know. But they've come such a long way with it. And they're, you know, like any parents, it was horrifying for them to go through it. And of course, they go through, what did we do to cause this? What did we? And it was really, I was close with my brother and he had a really hard time. Like he flew out here and he was very, it was hard for him. Like my brother had the hardest time because like, what happened to him? Like,
yeah.
What happened to my best friend and my brother? And so he's been the most like supportive over the, everyone has been, everyone's been.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, when I was in rehab, I met a lot of people that had the opposite, whose parents like disowned them. And I was just so grateful that I had a parent that like supported me and was willing to like...
They supported it. I mean, they were disappointed. They were, you know, but they weren't going to turn their back on me. But there were some dark, dark times with them. Okay. I mean, I apparently on that during my drug runs, you know, when I would go on like one of these 3-day binges, I apparently would call them in the middle of the night and tell them that this was their fault. Like, oof. I would do some crazy stuff that I don't remember. And so I had a lot of amends to make. And time does heal. And now, you know.
Time does heal. Yeah, I used to think that's such a, like, cliche thing to say. But it totally does.
It does. It's just sometimes you're just waiting for that time to happen. But
I remember when my dad was dying. They diagnosed him with a terminal disease. My mom's gone. I was, like, all alone. My dad was losing it, becoming basically a vegetable. And I was like, nothing's... I was just... In my head, I'm like, this is... What do I do with myself? This is like...
Right.
And, you know, people are like, you know, we just give it time. And I was like, that's bullshit. I kept pulling it
away. Time. Yeah.
And I look at myself now. I don't have it all together.
Right.
But, you know, I can't believe... This is the thing.
You got it more together than this guy over here.
Absolutely.
But I really think you just got to give yourself time. my dad used to say this to me, and I used to think it was stupid, but I kind of I like it. He's like, it's going to be okay at the end. And if it's not okay, it's not the end.
There you go.
And I was just like, all right.
Yeah. And that's
and
that's good.
And I think, honestly, just whenever I need help, I honestly just ask for it, too.
Yeah.
I realized
which is important.
It's so
which
important.
Which was hard for me to do because I want to be the one that solves everyone else's problems.
I tell everyone this, that asking for help is one of the bravest thing you can do. It's
absolutely
so vulnerable, but you, if you do it, it's so brave of you to do it. So,
Guy,
yes,
this is your intervention. Well, ask us for help.
I mean,
but I'm curious, do you have any advice for someone that is struggling right now out there?
What you just said is ask for help and never stop asking for help. And it does get better because people struggling out there, when you're in the midst of addiction, you genuinely believe that I can't do this. Like, I can't get clean. I can't stop. I've tried.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is you either die or you have that moment, whether someone forces you into that moment, whether a situation, but you will have to have that moment where you go, do I want to live? Or do I want to keep going this?
You watch a Hallmark Channel movie with James Woods.
There you go. And for me, that moment at the end sort of came after I thought, oh, I'm going to lose my daughter.
Right.
And I was like, what has happened? Like, how did my life get to be this? And I saw my career going away. The tough thing, though, about this, about what I do, not the tough thing, is that it's a much more forgiving industry than others. Like,
yeah.
I was in rehab with doctors and lawyers who were like, they were fucked. They were done.
Yeah.
Who's going to hire a doctor? Like, even as an addict, I was like, yeah, I get that I wouldn't go to a doctor who had a drug problem or had, you know, even one in recovery, you sort of question.
That's true.
And lawyers, I mean, and these people were looking at not just that they were sitting in a rehab in Arizona, they were looking at the fact that their careers were done. And I'm sitting there with an agent that says, when you're ready to work, let me know.
Right.
And that's
God,
this business.
So forgiving.
I mean, Andy Dick just said he got out of rehab. He's done rehab 18 times, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. So that says a lot.
Is he clean right now?
He is.
Yeah.
And when Andy's clean, he's a great
He's amazing.
Dude.
Yeah. We were friends for quite a while and then we lost touch. He's a great guy.
He really is. Speaking of addiction, you wrote an article called You're Not Broken, You're an Addict.
Yeah, I
did.
That
was right after Philip Seymour Hoffman passed, correct?
Yes. And I didn't write it as an article. I just wrote it as a long tweet. Someone then asked me, can I please print this? Someone who does a recovery something.
Okay.
And what were you saying?
Just wondering your reaction.
It just went, for some reason, it hit me hard when he had died.
Yeah.
And hearing a lot of people, see, that's the problem with Twitter is you start reading shit and people are going, he's a fucking idiot.
Yeah, right.
He deserves it. If you can have all that stuff and still do that, you're an idiot. If you have a kid and you can still go get high, you're an idiot.
Oh, no.
You know?
People who
if you have
it.
A career like him, that's one thing I do want to say, just going back to that also, is that for me, a huge part of getting healthy or healthier was also realizing that I had clinical depression.
Right.
And until I accepted that and took medication for that, that's why I was getting high. I'm an addict, but alcohol and drugs curbed that stuff because things were dark for me. And I didn't know why until I got high, and then it was okay. So I was full on self-medicating, and it wasn't until I got to rehab. And that's why I get someone struggling and they can't. Sometimes it's as easy as, you know, going to a reputable psychiatrist who will tell you one of the reasons you can't stop drinking is because here's what's going on. And, you know, I thank God I have medication now that keeps me at least on the light side of life.
Okay. Do you struggle with depression still?
I do. And I do. I have the right medication. What happened was, and I haven't talked about this, but about 2 years ago, I read an article somewhere saying that we're the most medicated country in the world and that we over-medicate. And after everything I'd been through, my head told me, maybe I overreacted to the depression thing. Maybe I don't need all this medication, but I wasn't going to tell my wife or anyone. And I started slowly taking myself off medication. And last summer, as soon as the season ended, you know, we always have this hiatus.
Yeah.
I went into a horrible spiral where I was convinced my wife was having an affair. I was convinced my kids would be better off without me.
Wow.
I was convinced that Ellen in the show, you know, and this was so real when you have depression. And I became so dark and so depressed, and I didn't want to eat, and I didn't want to function, and I didn't trust, and I basically had spiraled, and, you know, it got so dark that I finally said something to my wife and said, just so you know, I took myself off meds and things are really bad. And we rallied and I found a new psychiatrist and I got back on the right meds and it's been a great year. And by the time I got back to work, I was okay after 6 weeks off. Good. But I went into such a dark place that for the first time in years, I started thinking, maybe everyone would be better off without me, which is suicidal thinking.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how I had gotten there. You know, I had this great job, this great family, this great, and I eased right back into that place.
Yeah. And it sounds like what you're saying is for anybody in that situation, that's the thing to do is to ask for help.
I'm a big believer. I know this isn't popular with the Scientologists, but I'm a big believer in psychiatric drugs.
Right.
If you have real depression. I think it's important for people to understand that there's sadness and there's depression.
Yeah.
You know, oh my God, my boyfriend just dumped me. I'm so depressed. is different than laying in bed with a wife and kids in your house thinking, I want to die.
Yeah.
But let's just bring up that again, another positive. You are remarried now.
I am remarried.
You have more kids.
I have more kids.
They're all doing very well.
I have two twin boys. Wife number two wanted children, so we did two boys, and my daughter is amazing. She's at Oberlin College and she's doing great, and it's all good. And some days I feel grateful for all of it, and some days I go back to that thinking of like it's all going to get taken away, and I'm a piece of shit, and you know you struggle. It doesn't all get perfect, but it's just easier. There's moments of happiness as to where times I didn't have that, but I still struggle, and I'm still addicted to the idea of wanting to do something. Like, I went to Vegas this weekend for our anniversary.
Yeah.
I just want to buy cigarettes. I've been chewing Nicorette for like 9 years.
Yeah.
But I just want to buy cigarettes. It's like, people say, do you still struggle with wanting to drink? I get into Vegas, you want to do something bad.
Yeah.
And I still struggle with wanting to do something bad. That's a struggle for me.
You're not past the temptation.
I'm not past... at least thinking about the temptation.
Yeah.
I don't want to get high, but it's still I can very easily get right back into the head of what it felt like to be high and forget. And that's why you have to remember how bad it was in the bottom, because it's very easy to start remembering the good things and going, it did feel good to not feel.
So what helps you through that? Do you think that, I mean, Nicorette?
And I also think knowing that the feeling will pass.
Okay.
And that, but it's not always healthy. Like I don't always use the tools of the program. I'll go and spend money on clothing that I have no reason to be buying or no need to be buying. I'll go book a vacation that we don't really need to be taking, and I'll find other ways, or I'll eat, or I'll feed myself and fill the hole. And
as long as it's not hurting you.
Yeah.
As long as it's with vacations and not sticking needles in your arm, that's okay. So, Andy, we've taken a lot of your time so far.
I like it. I feel like I've been really boring.
You've been great.
Fascinating.
No.
We want to play a quick game with you.
Please.
And we want to... Well, let me ask you this. What's your favorite charity?
My favorite charity is... that's a great question. Basically, that's a good... I was actually talking about that today to my psychiatrist, in that I give every time I'm asked. Mm-hmm. So I've given to like a lot of like these causes on Twitter that show up.
Yeah.
Where people are raising funds for something for someone, I'll give to that. I would say probably it feels to me like the biggest charity is I try and give to education, to kids who can't, to scholarship funds, to kids who don't have the benefit of the kind of education my kids get.
Okay. So we're going to figure out a specific charity to give to, because we are going to give. It's just going to depend on you for how much. Oh, we do. This is part of the show. So I'm going to ask you a question. We want to see if you can guess who gave this quote on failure. Okay. Just like bodybuilding, failure is also a necessary experience for growth in our lives. For if we never tested our limits, how will we know how strong we really are? How will we ever grow?
Well, the only bodybuilder... Is it a bodybuilder?
Yes.
It's got to be either Schwarzenegger, because I don't know bodybuilder. Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Channing Tatum.
Okay.
Some Guido in New Jersey?
Yeah. I'm so way off. Who?
Okay. I'll give you one hint. Okay. What if I write it like this? Just like bodybuilding.
Schwarzenegger.
Okay. So you're correct. Congratulations.
Yes.
So here's what's going to happen. You're going to give me a number from
one. Are these pills?
No. You're going to give me a number from 1 to 100.
This is
just give me
so
a number
fun.
From none, 1 to I know. It's a very basic
game.
You should
have waited. Like we had a cooler game than this before.
Just give me one of these numbers from 1 to 100. Yes. And each number has its own dollar denomination. Okay.
86.
Okay. Let's see what 86 is.
Why did you have one from 100?
Like, I think I did. Maybe I did 50. Wait,
hold on.
You have
a lot of time on your hands
to
rip those apart.
Maybe I did 50, Andy. No, I did 50. Let's do sorry. I had it backwards.
Give
me
a
different number. Yes, give me a different number, Andy.
74.
1 to 50.
I'm not great with numbers. 37.
Okay, here's 37.
Twice not on Wall Street.
38. 37 is $50. But wait a second, Andy. You have a chance to double it. In this bag,
this is the greatest game ever.
It's either one.
By the way, whatever comes up here, I will match.
Okay, it's either one time
and let's
or two
do St. Jude's.
Okay, St. Jude's it is.
Otherwise, just changing it.
Is it going to be one time or two times your money here, Andy? What does that say? It might look
this
like.
It says four.
Ooh!
That's
well,
a mistake.
It's what you know what? That's what's
no,
going to be.
It's two. I don't know. I can't
let's see what it says. It says. Writing.
Let's call it two.
No, it says
seven.
It says one time, but I'm going to turn that
oh,
into.
Oh, it's a one.
I'm going to turn that into
yes,
four times.
No, not four
yes.
times. One time.
It's $200 to St. Jude's.
He wanted to match it.
I'm going to match it. So what is it? How much are we giving? 400?
Okay,
I'm giving 200.
Yes.
How about this? Since it was one time,
okay.
How about you give 50 and I'll give 350 to St. Jude's?
No. Let's do even amount. If nothing else, we'll do.
You
we'll
do 100, 100, I'll do 300, St. Jude's.
Okay.
Let's help the
deal.
Kids.
In your name. Thank you.
But it
Andy.
Has to be Jewish kids. Can we say that? Can we earmark money at St. Jude's
no
for Jewish children?
And,
should we just do Children's Hospital in L.A.? No, let's do St. Jude's.
We're going to do St. Jude's.
Can we just
yeah,
give it, can
yeah,
we give it to Grace?
I love that what's her name.
I like Danny Thomas and Marlo
I love,
Thomas.
I love Marlo, so
yes.
yeah.
That oh, girl.
Yeah, that girl.
Do you want to give him the gift on the air? Or do you want to
stop
give him,
it with gifts and money
and have
donations.
A little gift.
Who has all this money?
This is our version of Ellen.
Who has all this
okay.
money? This is your Ellen
not
games.
A big deal.
Yeah.
We're just going to
donate
on. That
hold on while the back of me is going to open up.
But
Ellen,
wait, can we talk about people from Twitter, or is that not allowed on this? That's more the nuzzy.
Yeah.
That's the nuzzy
that's
thing,
the nuzzy
right?
Show. But we shall say that you are on Twitter. You're hilarious. You're at Andy Lastner.
But that I wanted to get more. Well, once the microphones turn off, I want to get to know more of the people you know.
Oh, here it is.
No.
This is.
No, this is the greatest thing
a
ever.
Stanley Cup popcorn
no,
maker.
No, it's not. What are you guys doing?
It's a popcorn
I came
maker
here, I bored you for an hour, and you're giving
Cup.
Me gifts?
In the shape of Stanley Cup. Yes.
I know, but this is a podcast, and I've bored you. I haven't even been funny today.
Andy.
This is a disaster.
You were terrific. So, thank
this
you.
This is unbelievable. I'm not even kidding that I'm using this tonight.
Good. We're glad.
I was freaked out that he wouldn't
this is yeah. a Stanley Cup hot air popcorn maker. You have no idea the joy this is going to give me.
It like, gave
this
me a is, lot of joy. I want to buy one for myself.
How do you even find this?
I'm a master of all things kings. So.
Oh, my God. Why don't the three of us, I have three season tickets, the three of us mm-hmm. will go to a Kings game next year.
Done and
you're
done.
Into it sounds like, and he sort
I'm
of
I'm a former Ranger fan.
Yeah, they had a rough.
Oh, sorry,
anyway,
guys.
Go Kings
anyway,
go. We'll win the cup again this year.
Andy well, you
Lastner.
Won the cup.
I won the popcorn cup. Thank you so much.
Thank
and
you. Where else can we find you?
This was my
Twitter.
First podcast ever, and I had a great time.
Oh,
we're
we really appreciate
came.
You coming.
Thank
in.
You so you. Much for being on here. All right, thanks.